Welcome to this bi-monthly conflict-free leadership call hosted by the National Physicians Alliance as part of its unbranded doctor project, which takes place under the Partnership to Advance Conflict-Free Medical Education, known as the PACME grant. I am Rachel DeGolia, facilitator for this call and a board member of the National Physicians Alliance. In my day job, I direct the Universal Healthcare Action Network. So, according to our pre-registrations, as of earlier today, we have a pretty good mix of physicians, faculty, and students from around the country on this call. I know that the following states, at least, are included: California, Illinois, Maryland, New York, Ohio, Oregon, Texas, Virginia, Washington, Wisconsin, and D.C. If I missed anybody, call it out now. Otherwise, we're going to go ahead and get started. And what I'm going to ask, because of the number of people on the call, if everyone, could you please mute your line by pressing star 6? I'll give you a moment to do that now. And then when it comes time for Q&A, if you want to unmute your line, you can do that by pressing star 6 as well. This way everyone can hear better. All right, great. All right, so just a little background on the PACME project. The grant that supports the project stemmed from a settlement regarding the inappropriate marketing of the drug Neurontin. Organizational partners for the grant, in addition to MPA, are the American Medical Student Association, Community Catalyst, and the Pew Charitable Trust. The goal of the project is to reduce conflicts of interest created by the pharmaceutical industry in the medical profession and in medical research. And the partners on this grant promote a number of approaches to raise awareness of this issue and to build leadership in the medical profession to eventually eliminate some, if not all, conflicts. So, our topic tonight is working to reduce conflict of interest at the FDA, U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Our featured speaker is Dr. John Powers, Associate Clinical Professor of Medicine at George Washington University School of Medicine. John formerly was the lead medical officer for antimicrobial drug development and resistance initiatives in the Office of Antimicrobial Products. I hope I pronounced that right. Center for Drug Evaluation and Research at the FDA, where he was responsible for issues related to clinical trials and policy in antimicrobial research. And prior to joining the FDA, John was assistant professor in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, where he is still on the faculty as an assistant clinical professor of medicine. He also sees patients weekly in clinic. Tonight, John will discuss the work, among other things, of the NPA's task force on the Food and Drug Administration, including some current efforts related to conflicts of interest and antibiotics. And so before we invite John to make some remarks, let me just say a word about the format for our call. After John's remarks, in about, 9:25 or so, we will throw the floor open for Q&A. Joining John in responding to questions and participating in the discussion will be Reshma Ramachandran, who is a fourth-year medical student at Brown Medical School and a second-year master's in public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. In 2012, Reshma was the American Medical Student Association's Farm-Free Fellow and is currently working in China, calling in tonight from China, thank you, Reshma, with the Harvard Global Health Institute on increasing access to biologics. So she will share information about some additional resources and new tools designed to reduce conflict of interest at academic medical centers and in the medical profession. Now, just a few words from Ann Wollison, who is our Director of Education for the National Physicians Alliance, and then we'll get right to our presentation. Ann?
Okay, thank you, Rachel, and thanks, everyone, for joining us tonight, and thank you, Dr. Powers and Reshma, for presenting on the call tonight. We really appreciate it. So I'm Ann Wollison with the National Physicians Alliance, and again, I thank you for joining us tonight to learn more about NPA's FDA task force. I just wanted to give you a quick reminder about MPA PACME-related resources, and PACME is the Partnership to Advance Conflict-Free Medical Education, a project of four partners, which Rachel already mentioned. And I just want to remind people that we have archived leadership development calls like these and national grand rounds, which can be found on NPA's website at www.npalliance.org. /conflict-free. So we'll repeat that at the end of the night, but all of our past calls and our grand rounds are able to be found at that link. I would encourage people to check it out. There are a number of calls related to the partnership's work to reduce conflicts of interest, including information on the AMHSA Farm-Free Scorecard, the Physician Sunshine Payment Act, ghostwriting, pharmaceutical industry marketing, and much more. Some of our national grand rounds include the opportunity to access CME. So again, please visit NPA's website to learn more about PACME resources and the FDA task force. And I don't know that Rachel mentioned that if you have questions during the presentation, I would ask that you please send them to me at I'll just say it one time. You might want to jot this down. It's ann.woloson@npalliance.net, and we'll remind people about that after the presentation. And it seemed like there was one more thing that I wanted to mention, but I'll stop there. Thank you for joining us.
We're having a little bit of a problem with the conflict-free page on the website right now, just today. That will be fixed shortly, but in case people decide to go look at it right after this call and you have trouble finding it, come back again. Hopefully tomorrow we'll have it all straightened out.
Okay.
All right, so the email for questions again is ann.woloson, W-O-L-O-S-O-N, at npalliance.net. Please, as a courtesy, send your questions to Ann. She'll compile them, and that will help us with our Q&A after John's remarks.
Okay, and is Dr. Powers on the line?
Yes, I'm here.
All right,
okay, great.
Welcome.
Yeah.
So we have Dr. Ann Powers, who's going to tell us about the work of NPA's task force on the FDA, including efforts to reduce conflicts of interest and inappropriate use of antibiotics. Welcome, John.
Thanks, Rachel. Thanks, Ann. I think Ann sent around some slides that I had put together for this talk as well, but I'll go on the presumption that people might not have these, so I'll talk our way through this. So I was asked to talk tonight on the efforts of the NPA FDA task force. And what I'd like to do is give a little bit of the history of the NPA FDA task force, the goals of this group, and then some of our current work regarding antibiotics and FDA that includes issues that relate to conflict of interest. So the history of this is that NPA's executive director, Gene Silver-Eisenstadt, was involved in an informal coalition of patient and consumer groups. It's actually called the Patient and Consumer Coalition. And these public health groups had gotten together to interact and work together on issues that related to FDA. And as these issues came more and more to the fore, NPA decided to form a task force within NPA to specifically address these growing number of issues regarding the efficacy and safety of medical interventions. And those medical interventions include drugs, biologics, and devices. So the composition of this group you can actually find on NPA's website at npaalliance.org/npa-fda-task-force-members. And that's written down on the slides for those of you that have them. The chairpersons of this group are Lisa Plimate, who is a general internal medicine and geriatrician in Seattle, Washington, and then Reshma Ramachandran, who is on the call with us tonight as well. The mission of this group that you can actually find on the NPA website, it's the easiest way to get to this is it's npaalliance.org/FDA-taskforce, and you can get to everything else related to this group from that main link. The mission of this group is to educate and empower a multi-specialty group of NPA members free of conflict of interest, to provide unbiased expertise in evaluating and responding to the FDA regulatory process in a way that maximizes meaningful clinical outcomes for our patients. The guiding principles of this group are that we believe that the nation's food supply should be kept safe for immediate consumption and should also cause no harm to our population over time. And that's an important issue because the FDA's, the first letter in that is Food and Drug Administration. And in fact, the history of FDA is such that in the early 1900s, almost everything they did was related to food safety. The second principle is we believe that drug, biologic, and medical device regulation should be based in transparency, integrity, and accountability, and firmly grounded in scientific evidence and driven by public health interests. And you'll see some of the efforts that we are working on currently are really addressed to that specific guiding principle. We also strongly support the development of meaningful new treatment options for patients and recognize the need to improve the efficiency of clinical trials to expedite obtaining clinically relevant information. So we're all for trying to get the best information in an expeditious way, but we still want information that's actually going to show us how and when to use new medical interventions in ways that help patients and not just that make more money for pharmaceutical companies. We certainly believe that you're allowed to make money from these products, but the issue is that you should be do well by doing good for patients at the same time. We believe that the process used to approve these options should be based on substantial evidence from adequate and well-controlled clinical trials. And in fact, that is the legal standard that's in the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of how drugs are supposed to be approved regarding both the safety and efficacy of products and procedures. And finally, as providers, we believe that the FDA regulatory process, including policies on dissemination of information by FDA, pharmaceutical device manufacturers and researchers, should allow us to make informed clinical decisions in a way that optimizes patient health and safety. One of the things that we've actually done is publish several informative pieces on the NPA blog. And I won't go through the website that links that, but I actually wanted to quote a paragraph that Lisa Plimate, one of our chairpersons, wrote in a blog that came out a few months ago. And I think this is very instructive because in one simple paragraph, it kind of explains the whole idea behind this group. And what Lisa wrote was, in recent years, physicians have found themselves in growing tension with the pharmaceutical industry as our respective interests do not always coincide and in some cases directly conflict. Yes, physicians want real innovation. We need better diagnostic tools and we need truly novel drugs. We want to work with pharma, the NIH, and the FDA to encourage development, but we must always assure to the best of our abilities that drugs are thoroughly tested before being released to the public. We want to offer our patients, especially those with novel disorders or fatal disabling diseases, real hope, but not false hope. This is where we must step up to defend the regulatory rigor of the FDA. Drug and device companies may see regulation as a roadblock to discovery and growth. We see regulation as a critical line of defense for public health. Well-done, scientifically-based regulation provides the best pathway to achieve real and lasting innovation. As physicians, we want to know that we can trust the label FDA approved. I think that basically says all of it about what this group is trying to accomplish. Some of the recent work that we've done as a part of this group, which Lisa reminded me yesterday, we're just sort of coming up on the one-year anniversary of the formation of this group. Our first get-together was actually in July of 2013. So in that year, we've actually signed on and helped to draft multiple letters to FDA and Congress regarding issues in FDA regulation of medical interventions. We've also sent comments to FDA on guidances that they have put out in the last year, including a number of them related to antibiotics, as well as some guidances on other therapeutic areas as well. Some of our members of the NPA task force have also attended and presented at the open public hearing parts of FDA advisory committees. And this included an FDA advisory committee on how antibiotic resistance is actually defined, and then most recently an FDA advisory committee that reviewed two new antibiotics for skin infections. And I think our members found that both a very instructive process as well as one where they had a big impact on the discussions. In fact, Nita Degasis, who's also the president of ANSA and is on our group, was actually quoted in the Wall Street Journal based on her participation in that last advisory committee. We've also, as I read from Lisa's blog, we've published several NTA blogs on various regulatory issues, and we've actually had monthly conference calls every month since last July. And those conference calls discuss all of the issues that I've just laid out for you that we've been working on, but we also have in the initial 20 minutes a learning session which actually talks about some topic related to FDA regulatory issues. We've actually gone through understanding the basic principles and the legal basis for FDA regulation, and we've also had discussions from invited speakers related to several issues regarding legislative efforts as well. And we're planning on continuing to have more guest speakers to discuss some of these issues as well. And then most recently, we've really been working on legislative issues regarding antibiotics. So just to sort of summarize what's going on here, I think most people realize that effective antibiotics have had a huge impact on public health. Sulfa drugs were first studied in the 1930s, and penicillin was studied in the 1940s. And those drugs actually had a remarkable ability to decrease morbidity and mortality from infectious diseases. What most people don't realize is that antibiotics were also the first drug trials that employed methods to decrease bias. So some of the methodologies that we have used regularly now, like randomization and trials, blinding of treatment groups, control groups, and placebos, were all first used in antibiotic trials back in the 1940s and the 1950s. However, what happened was in the 1980s, multiple antibiotics started to be approved by comparing one antibiotic to an older antibiotic whose effectiveness wasn't clear to begin with. And so what happened then were that at least 60 new drug applications, which were submitted to FDA, were approved for self-resolving illnesses like ear infections in children, sinusitis in healthy adults, and bronchitis. And so what happened there was that these drugs actually were never proven to be effective in the first place. And not only do those drugs cause side effects, direct side effects for patients, but they actually have a big impact on spreading antibiotic resistance as well. So the other issue that's become pretty clear is that there's an intrinsic link between pharmaceutical companies wanting to sell more drugs and inappropriate usage of antibiotics and the spread of antibiotic resistance. So using antibiotics inappropriately in patients, for instance, that have viral infections and don't have a bacterial infection, or even if they have a bacterial infection like bacterial sinusitis, in fact, NIH recently funded a placebo-controlled trial that was published in JAMA, which again showed, and this is not the first study to do this, this is one of multiple studies, that showed no effect of antibiotics in the treatment of acute bacterial sinusitis in otherwise healthy adults. So what's happened, though, is that given the emergence of antibiotic resistance, much sort of like the financial issues where companies like AIG kind of caused the financial crisis and then asked for a bailout afterwards, drug companies are now saying that they need incentives to develop new antibiotics because their feeling is they don't make enough money off of current antibiotics. Just to be clear on that, the current antibiotic market is somewhere between $27 to $42 billion with a B dollars a year. But companies claim that's not enough for them in comparison to other drugs like erectile dysfunction drugs where they make more money. So what's happened is the drug industry and groups which are linked to the drug industry have been lobbying Congress and FDA to lower the standards for approval of antibiotics. And remarkably, this is happening despite recent drug trials with new antibiotics, which have actually shown an increase in mortality with new antibiotics compared to the older drugs, which were the control drugs in those clinical trials. The other issue is there is in truth an unmet medical need for patients who have disease that is resistant to currently available antibiotics. But the tack that FDA has taken is to actually allow new drugs to be studied in patients that have multiple other effective antibiotic options to allow the new drug to be somewhat less effective than the old drug in that setting and then just to assume that the new drug is going to be superior in effectiveness in these older, sicker patients who don't have any options. So in fact, what we're doing there is we're putting current patients with susceptible disease at risk of less effective drugs, and then assuming that those drugs are going to be more effective than older drugs in the setting of antibiotic resistance. The other thing that industry is calling for is to rely on animal studies and pharmacokinetic modeling instead of actually doing randomized trials in patients with disease. And unfortunately, it's been proven again and again that those animal studies and modeling are not reliable measures of whether a drug is effective in patients. In fact, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality just came out with a 1,700-study review of pharmacokinetic modeling and stated that there was no evidence that it actually demonstrated benefits for patients. The other issue is that the outcome measures in studies that the drug companies are pushing that these outcome measures be based on laboratory tests, such as killing a bacteria in a test tube, rather than patient-centered outcomes such as death, disability, or an improvement in the patient's symptoms. And what's kind of remarkable about this is that really effective drugs like penicillin and sulfa drug had remarkable benefits on decreasing mortality back in the 1930s and 40s. So when you really have an effective antibiotic, it can actually be shown to decrease death with a very small sample size for the trial, usually less than 100 patients. And finally, what companies are calling for is something called limited approval. And that is unclear what that actually means, whether they're calling for a very small data set in terms of the evidence to approve a drug or to approve a drug in some small population of patients. And interestingly, antibiotics are probably the worst place to try to limit drug usage because we already know that about 50% of antibiotics are used inappropriately according to data from the CDC in patients who don't even have a disease. And because of the lack of rapid, accurate bedside diagnostics for most infections, antibiotics are used empirically in a large number of patients. So therefore, it's impossible without accurate diagnostics to actually use the drug in a limited population, even if the drug is approved according to that methodology. On the next slide, for those of you who haven't, I mentioned earlier that it's almost stunning that this is happening in the setting when recent antibiotics that have been studied have actually increased mortality compared to older drugs. And on this next slide, I listed a couple of examples. A drug called bedaquiline was approved in December of 2012 by FDA for multidrug-resistant tuberculosis. This drug caused a five-fold increase in mortality when it was added on to the four standard TB drugs that are commonly used in patients already. So, importantly, this drug was studied by adding it on to already available therapies. It was not compared just to placebo, but to effective options that already exist, and yet it increased mortality by fivefold. The FDA label for this drug says to reserve it for appropriate patients, but it's unclear what kind of patient would actually benefit from a drug that increases mortality by five times. The drug telavancin was approved for hospital-acquired pneumonia, even though it increased mortality in patients with renal failure. The drug doripenem was approved for skin infections and abdominal infections, but it increased mortality in two separate randomized trials in hospital-acquired pneumonia. And what's interesting about that is what happens over and over again with these antibiotics is that when you study sicker patients, like patients with hospital-acquired pneumonia, those are the patients in whom these drugs are seen to fail. When these drugs are studied in healthier patients, they appear to be what's called non-inferior to the older drugs, but that's because they don't study patients who are sick enough. The importance of that is that patients who harbor resistant pathogens are usually, on average, older and sicker than the patients who have susceptible pathogens. The drug daptomycin failed when it was studied in a clinical trial of community-acquired pneumonia. The drug tigecycline increased mortality in a meta-analysis published by NIH critical care physicians. The drug ceftobiprole failed.
Everybody needs to hit star 6 to mute your lines. We are hearing some background talking. Sorry, John. Star 6 to mute your lines. Okay, go ahead.
And finally, the drug ceftobiprole was studied in hospital-acquired pneumonia. And that drug also failed to show benefits in hospital-acquired pneumonia. And those trials also had data integrity issues where FDA could not verify the actual data from the clinical trial itself. The important thing is that for all of these drugs, they're not studied to actually show superior effectiveness on patient-centered outcomes in patients who have disease due to resistant pathogens. These drugs are studied to actually rule out how much worse in effectiveness the new drug is compared to the old drug. And that particular methodology is called non-inferiority trials, which kind of doesn't make sense that we're actually doing studies in that way when what we're actually interested in is drugs that have improved effectiveness in the setting where patients don't have other options. And again, I mentioned earlier, by doing studies in this way, we're actually putting current patients who have effective options at risk from less effective drugs. It's also this makes the issue that this is actually ethically questionable, that we're putting current patients at risk for no benefit to themselves. And again, we're then extrapolating that these drugs are going to be effective in the population who really need them that don't have effective options. What's happened recently, though, is that there have been several legislative initiatives that really try to lower the standards for antibiotic approvals even further than FDA's legal standard of substantial evidence from adequate and well-controlled trials. The GAIN Act, which stands for Get Antibiotic Incentives Now, was passed as part of FDA legislation in 2012. And this gives extended exclusivity, which means protection from generic drugs, to any antibiotic that is active in the test tube against a long list of resistant pathogens that FDA came up with. And in fact, if you think of an organism, it's probably on that list. So what this means is that any new antibiotic that comes down the pike essentially gets a priority review, which means that it gets reviewed faster by FDA, and after it gets approved, it gets 5 to 7 years of protection against a generic drug. More recently, Representative Gingrey from Georgia has promoted the ADAPT bill. And the ADAPT bill changes the standard for antibiotic approvals to allow drugs to be approved on test tube tests. The pharmacokinetic modeling, which I described earlier, that's already been shown not to predict benefits for patients, and some vague language called approval based on limited data sets or something called alternative endpoints, which most likely means endpoints based on laboratory tests instead of patient-centered outcomes. In apropos of our discussion tonight about conflict of interest, the second part of this bill actually outsources defining antibiotic resistance in the test tube to an outside group that actually includes drug company employees as its members. So these are not just people who take money from drug companies. These are actually folks who work for drug companies as their day job. And so our grave concern here is this is essentially allowing the drug industry to regulate itself. And what can happen here is that if they change the definitions for antibiotic resistance, it will make it appear that older drugs are less effective and shunt physicians towards usage of newer, more expensive, and potentially less effective or more toxic drugs without any evidence that those new drugs are better. And a study out of Johns Hopkins actually showed that applying these definitions that this group wants to use could raise the apparent antibiotic resistance in the hospital by 300%, even though it results in no benefits for patients at all. A second bill that's being promoted is called DISARM, and this bill forces hospitals to pay what's called premium prices for antibiotics that are not shown to be better than current drugs. And discussions here have involved taking the price of antibiotics, the most expensive of which is about $800 for a 14-day course, and raising that price to about $30,000 for a course of antibiotics. And so this is very concerning that we would be asking patients to foot the bill for these drugs, which actually aren't demonstrated to be any better than older, less expensive drugs. So what we've been working on here is planning a day in Congress on June 12th to actually show members the actual data on these issues. We've also tried to start a letter-writing campaign to members, and I hope Reshma is going to discuss more of this after I conclude. We're also planning a meeting, hopefully sometime later in the fall, to discuss appropriate design of clinical trials for antibiotics. And out of that, we're trying to publish a white paper and a position piece in a medical journal on these appropriate principles for antibiotic clinical trials. Just to finish up here, I'd like to say that really our concern here is not just about antibiotics. Antibiotics here are the poster child for the same issues that are coming up in other therapeutic areas. The pharmaceutical industry has tried to promote these same kinds of ideas of limited approval in diabetes drugs, drugs for obesity, and cancer drugs as well. The issue here is that antibiotics are the poster child for this because people widely assume that all antibiotics are effective, when in fact I've shown you recent evidence that shows that they're not. And this raises a lot of issues for us as physicians regarding the ethics of clinical trials, really some really important ideas about medical professionalism. Is this the kind of stuff we want to do for our patients? Are we going to put our current patients at risk in this kind of clinical research that's not scientifically valid? And how does this really conform to the medical principle of first do no harm if we're enrolling patients into studies where the prime goal is to show how much worse a new drug might be compared to an old drug? So I think that's the rest finish up my remarks there, and Rachel and Ann, I'll pass it back to you.
Thank you, John. That somehow was pretty darn shocking. All right, so you've given us a lot to chew on. Let me just remind people, send your questions, email them to Ann, A-N-N dot Wollosen, W-O-L-O-S-O-N, at npalliance.net. And we'll get to them in just a moment. But first, I would like to invite Reshma Ramachandran from AMSA, formerly with AMSA, to provide an initial response to John DeMarco and add to it what some information you have that you can share with us, Reshma, about the resources available for medical students and physicians who want to do more about these issues. Please.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. Can you hear me?
I'm coming across here.
Great. John, thank you so much for your talk. And John, you know, especially in the initial months of the task force has been kind of instrumental in giving us a lot of the background on the FDA and the issues with not only the clinical trials but also the ethical issues occurring both on the Hill and with physicians in deciding, what sort of antibiotics and other drugs they should be prescribing to their patients. So all this has been eye-opening. Each time I hear the talk, I learn something new. So thanks so much for that. John mentioned that on June 12th, a group of folks from the MTA FDA Task Force, including Lisa and John, will be going to Capitol Hill to talk to Congress about some of these legislation that he mentioned, including ADAPT and DISARM. ADAPT and DISARM are both bills that have been introduced fairly recently, and we just heard actually that one of the lead sponsors for the ADAPT bill is not running for re-election, so there's some concern that the bill might be pushed even more quickly, and has already garnered support from the American Medical Association, IDSA, and other professional societies, as well as the American Public Health Association, so some pretty big groups that have been supporting this bill and kind of been misinforming the public in terms of the actual benefits. So what we're hoping to do on June 12th is to talk to Congress about what sorts of things need to be included into bills on antibiotics and to discuss the appropriate design of clinical trials. So a lot of these bills use this term called unmet medical need. And when we ask industry and we ask people who support the bill, what does that mean? There's not really a specific definition, and people tend to dodge around this. So what we want to do is, specifically define what an unmet medical need, but also emphasize that we should be focusing on patients and not the bugs themselves. We want to have better trials and better antibiotics, and we shouldn't be passing legislation that that incentivizes companies to do lower standard trials to get the drugs out more quickly. But to be doing better trials to have better antibiotics that actually have robust evidence and also robust evidence for safety as well. A lot of these antibiotics that John mentioned have, pretty grave safety concerns, and that's something we want to emphasize to Congress as well. A critical component to this, though, is that we need more members on the FDA task force. We have a great group right now, but we want the task force to grow and include, more types of physicians. Specifically, if there's any oncologists in the audience, there's a lot of legislation on biologics that's kind of been festering on Capitol Hill. There's a lot of concern around oncology drugs being approved and the different incentives in terms of clinical trial approval, but also pricing of these drugs. So that's something we'd love to have folks who work in that area specifically. But really, we want as many people as possible. NTA, I think time and time again, when it's met with people from Capitol Hill and also with FDA folks, we're in the minority. We're usually the only professional, only physician group, only professional society out there that's trying to ask the question, where are these better trials? What's the evidence for approval? And one great example of this is when NIDA most recently went to testify in front of the FDA. She was pretty much the only person who was talking about the concerns around the clinical trials for the drugs that were going to be approved. There were consumer groups there, but she was the only physician who was speaking on the behalf of other physicians on the concerns about the lower standards for drug approval. And so we need more folks to be testifying from the FDA, doing visits not only on Capitol Hill but in district meetings, letter writing campaigns. You might have noticed in newspapers recently, in the Washington Post and the New York Times, there's been article after article about antibiotics, superbugs, exaggerating the crisis about the dearth of antibiotics and why we need to get them approved much more quickly than ever before. And we need more people to be available to write letters to say, what we need is not necessarily more antibiotics. We need better antibiotics. And so the one thing we want to ask, for the folks on the call who are interested in these topics, please, please do join a task force. Or, if you find an article or something that is concerning, is related to the FDA, that you'd like to learn more about or respond to, please email us. And let us know. We're always looking for people to advocate, either formally or informally on these issues. And the more physicians' voices we have out there, the better. There's not enough of us advocating on behalf of our patients about this. For resources, John mentioned, we have a number of blog posts on the FDA Task Force website. There will be a monthly blog post about the different activities the task force is engaged in. NIDA is going to be putting together a short piece about her experience testifying. The next month, we'll have Richard Bruno talking about a topic related to the FDA. If for folks who are just even interested in learning about some of these topics, again, John mentioned that each month we have an expert speaker who comes and gives a presentation, and these are usually recorded. And we've had topics as varied as antibiotics in animal feed. We've had topics on medical devices from Diana Zuckerman from the National Center of Research for Women and Families. After that, we actually went to Pew Charitable Trust and the core medical device meeting for unmet medical needs, and was able to push back based on the stuff we learned from Diana Zuckerman and from our own work writing letters on specific topics. We'll be having hopefully a talk later this summer on the new World Health Organization guidelines on antibiotics. There's a big, at the World Health Assembly most recently, there were multiple groups that came together in a coalition to set up principles on antibiotics and increasing incentives for research and development for better antibiotics and going away from financial incentives like the GAIN Act. So there's a lot of stuff happening and a lot of resources out there that are both on the website but on these monthly calls. And so if you have a question or if there's something of interest to you that you want the task force to address, we'd love to hear from you. And, of course, we want all of you to join. But if anybody's in Capitol Hill or in D.C. area on June 12th, we'd love to have you join us there to talk to congressmen. We'll be having letters and leave-behinds prepared. If afterwards, if you want to do an in-district meeting, there is a recess happening the first week of June, but there'll be obviously other recesses during July and August. We can set up in-district meetings for you to talk about these topics to your local representative. And the more we push back on these issues and the more we get Congress to pay attention about the need for better trials and better antibiotics, the better for our patients.
So, Reshma and John, could you each just share your email addresses?
Sure. Mine is jpowers3, that's J-P-O-W-E-R-S, and the number 3, at AOL.com.
Okay. Reshma, how about you?
My email is reshmagar@gmail.com.
All right.
We also Lisa's email is lisaplymate@comcast.net.
Okay, great. That's for people to follow up to join the task force or to get more information directly from one of you. Okay, great. So now for the remainder of the call, we're going to do some Q&A. Do you have some questions there for us, Anne, that people have emailed you?
Yeah, I have a bunch of questions, and I do want to remind people, as John mentioned at the beginning of his presentation, he put together a really nice slide set that was included in the confirmation that everybody received with the telephone number to this call. So I would, if you're interested in seeing that slide set or referring back to it, go back to the confirmation that you received regarding this call, and I believe that Becky Martin is also going to try to get them up on the MTA website after the call in the next day or so. So I'll stop there. I'll ask a few questions, and then I'm not sure if Lisa Plymate is actually joining us tonight, but it might be nice to hear just a minute from her if she's here. But let me ask a few of these questions. Some of them have already been answered, so the basics. Are you looking for new members? And it sounds like you would welcome new members.
Answer is yes.
And yes, and the way to do that is probably to reach out to either John, Reshma, or Lisa, and they did give their emails. One basic question was, how does the task force decide its priorities and what you're working on?
This is Lisa. I've been on the call, and I think John and Reshma did a fantastic job. That was really great. How do we decide on our priorities? Well, we started with, we have these informational sessions, and we have topics, and we have really good speakers, and they get us motivated. Maybe things that we read about in papers or journals, it can be just in the common press or in peer-reviewed journals. But we discuss we bring them up. They're very open meetings. People email each other between our meetings. And whatever topics people get really interested in. I mean, there are occasions when we decide we're spread too thin and we can't possibly take on anything else right now, but that kind of thing. But on the whole, we focus on things that people are really interested in and that we have some expertise in. And that's one of the reasons I've been particularly pushing to get an oncologist on this is because we really have a need for someone to review some of those drugs as well. And we, have issues on cardiovascular drugs, antihypertensive drugs, diabetic drugs, and all of these things. So we have an endocrinologist on our task force. But the more specialists we can get, the better off we are. But we have people with a wide range. We have people who are in, rehab medicine and people who are in primary care and, all kinds of people with different backgrounds. And so we appreciate whatever anybody brings to the table, and we'll do what we can do. But we're limited by the number of people that we have and the fact that we don't really have grants to support us at this point. But we're hopeful that we will be able to get some funding in the future so that we can expand and have staff support. We do get good help from the MTA staff, which we really appreciate. But it would be nice if we could also help contribute to salaries. But That's enough for that question, I think.
Thank you. Thank you, Lisa. We appreciate that you're joining us tonight very much and the work that you're doing. Another question that we've received is, does the CDC have anything to say about these less effective, less safe antibiotics that John talked about?
That's a really good question. Having worked at FDA for 10 years before I went to my current job, FDA and CDC have very different points of view and what they actually do. Unfortunately, what happens is that sometimes when CDC gets involved in areas that they're interested in, they have their own particular biases. For instance, at the FDA Advisory Committee on this drug, bedaquiline, for multidrug-resistant tuberculosis, it was actually the person on the committee from the CDC who was the most pushing for this drug. And the idea was that FDA hadn't approved a new drug, a new class of drugs. Not true, they hadn't approved any drugs, but they hadn't approved a new class of drugs for tuberculosis in 40 years. Well, that points out the problem. It points out the need. It doesn't say that a drug that kills five times more people meets that need. I would say on the flip side of it that CDC has been instrumental in trying to address this issue of inappropriate use of antibiotics, and they have a program called Get Smart. That program is chronically underfunded in terms of being able to raise awareness about inappropriate antibiotic usage and to try to educate people on those issues. But in terms of how those trials are designed, that's strictly an FDA issue, and CDC doesn't get involved in that.
Well, that's interesting and something to think about, I think, in terms of if there's any mechanism for trying to get them interested and involved down the road. Just add that to your list of priorities, okay? All right, we have some more questions. Has the task force reviewed, and I think this question will be asked a little bit more broadly, but has the task force reviewed the ethical dimensions of cost related to the new hepatitis C drugs?
We haven't explicitly spoke about this. This is the Sovaldi. The recent hepatitis C drug that was announced, and we've seen a lot of national media, and some of our partner organizations have been working really closely on this, including Public Citizen. But we haven't addressed this itself in the task force yet, although we circulated one article about it recently. Again, we're limited by the number of people we have and the many priorities we want to pursue, but that's definitely something that we've at least taken note of, but we haven't gone forward.
I think we're addressing this in a related issue, in that this disarm bill is actually calling to kind of codify what that drug has tried to do, and that is forcing patients and payers to pay much higher prices for these drugs than has habitually been charged in the past. And that hepatitis C drug, again, the drug company says that they justify charging that because they're saving lives and decreasing hepatic cancers, when in fact the outcome measure in that study was that they decreased the amount of hepatitis C virus in the blood, and they have not directly evaluated whether they stop any of those bad outcomes in patients. So again, that gets to the issues that we have addressed in the task force of, you know, measure what you say is what you're actually doing for patients, rather than laboratory tests and then inferring benefit based on those.
That's a good segue into this next question, which is a little more specific. But let's see if you have any thoughts on it. How can a clinical trial be ethically structured in the sickest patients for their existing drugs? How can you offer them a study arm with an unproven med?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The basics of research is that you should be offering patients the potential for benefit. And that gets to the issue that that new intervention should, based on preclinical and early clinical information, have some added benefits for the patients to sign up for the trial above and beyond currently available therapies. And that really is an important ethical dimension that is completely ignored in these non-inferiority trials. I think one of the things we're trying to address in this task force is there have been no studies, but it's our hypothesis, that patients don't really know what they're signing up for when they get into these studies. So, you know, you're a patient, you're sick in the hospital with pneumonia, and you sign up for a study comparing new antibiotic A to old antibiotic B. But you don't know that new antibiotic A, the primary goal of that study, is to rule out that new antibiotic A is 15% worse than what you could have gotten anyway. So what we're saying is that the only ethical way to actually do those studies is in the setting of patients that don't have other options, where the drug would be superior in effectiveness and offer patients added benefits. Now, added benefits could mean a drug that is similar in effectiveness that has a better side effect profile as well. So there are benefits for patients other than improved effectiveness. But in that setting, you're still talking about an added benefit for patients in that particular setting.
Well, that makes sense. I see what you're saying. So I have a couple more questions, and I want to remember before we sign off to repeat the emails for the three members of the task force, John, Risha, and Lisa, before we finalize the call. But I do have a couple more questions. Are you familiar with the FDA's financial conflict of interest waiver process, and how often is it used?
That's a really good question. In 2007, the FDA Amendments Act was passed as a part of FDA legislation, which limited the amount of waivers that FDA could grant for conflict of interest on their advisory committees. In the 2012 legislation called FDASIA, the industry tried to push back on that and allowed more and more people to get on the advisory committees who have conflicts of interest. Their thought is that if people don't have a conflict, that somehow they're not qualified to be on the advisory committees. We don't believe that's true. There's plenty of conflicted. A lot of us are on this call, right? So the idea that there aren't unconflicted people that could actually offer an informed viewpoint at these advisory committees, really, at least in my own personal estimation, borders on the ridiculous. So FDA is now empowered to allow more conflicted people onto their advisory committees, not less, based on the 2012 law.
We did notice there was one case I'll bring up that's related. There was a physician who was on the head of the skin infection approval committee, drug approval committee. John, you might remember this, who was called out because she had actually gone to an industry-funded event to speak to industry, about how to get their drugs approved quickly, and methods, ways to ensure better approval of their drug for skin infection. And this was published, her participation in this, because she didn't report this as a conflict of interest, or she didn't report this. She didn't, in her academic setting at Harvard Medical School, but also in other academic events, she didn't report that she'd been doing this. She was called out in national media, in a couple of mostly medical-related media articles on her participation, and she actually had released a statement saying, you know, apologizing for not disclosing these types of industry relationships and saying that she would not participate in the future in such events. So people are paying attention to this, and it's a good idea to keep track if you go to a conference and whatnot. If you do see somebody who's from the FDA, FDA various approval committees, to take note what sorts of conflicts they disclose and they don't disclose.
Just one thing I'd mention is that, as you said, as we get involved in this task force, you realize how extremely complex all of this really is. And we do try to limit ourselves to issues that relate to the FDA itself, because there's a whole other set of issues related to the pharmaceutical industry. But we're focusing on what we see as our court of last resort, and it's helping us try to preserve their basic functions as a regulatory agency. I'd also mention that on our task force, in addition to John and his considerable experience at the FDA, we have two other members who have spent a long, you know, many years, about 10 years each, working in the FDA. So we have, and they no longer are, but they have inside information, you know, insider's information, and can help us with understanding what the FDA does, their function. So that's another good thing on the task force, I think.
All right. You got another question, Marianne?
I do. It may be a little too long-winded for the next 5 minutes. I'm just trying to figure out the best use of time.
Why don't I do that real quick while you figure that out?
Okay.
So John Powers is jpowers3@aol.com. Right, John?
That's right.
And Reshma is R-E-S-H-M-A-G-A-R, Reshma Gar, @gmail.com. Is that correct, Reshma? Reshma?
Yes.
Okay, and then Lisa Plymate, her name, LisaPlymate, @contact.net?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Those are the three leadership people for the FDA Task Force. I think if you are interested in getting involved, you could email any or all of them. All right, Anne, one more question?
Well, instead of the question, because I don't think we can really cover it all, and it just talks about the committee process and how often they need to report their conflicts and so forth, I thought what might be helpful, and each of the speakers touched on this, is one, repeat where this work is found on the MPA website. Now, I know the MPA website is having trouble tonight, but I know that there are some interesting things on there that people on the call might want to see, like a letter that was recently written to members on Capitol Hill about concerns that they have around the issue of antibiotics. And I think it's a very good letter and concise. And I think it would be helpful for people to see that. So the repeat where that is found on the NPA website. But then Reshma also talked about the day in Congress. I think she said June 12th. And then a couple other ways that people might be able to get involved, not only on Capitol Hill, but locally. So if somebody wants to just jump in and remind people about those things, I think that would be a great way to end the call.
You know, I think the easiest way is if you go on the NPA website and under projects, the FDA Task Force is a project. And that way you can just start with npalliance.org, go to projects, and you can click on the FDA Task Force. Do you want to add to that, Lisa or Reshma?
This is Becky. If I could just add for a moment, and just a clarification, it's only the page where the archive of these calls that we're having a problem with on the web tonight. Everything else is working fine, so you can do like Rachel suggested, go to the projects tab on our homepage of the website, and you can get to the FDA task force or into our conflict of interest project. But by tomorrow, we should have the archive page for these conference call recordings fixed and ready for you to visit also. And that's where we'll post a copy of John's slides, and then we'll also have following up with written notes that will be available from that page. But everything else is working fine. And you can always contact me if there's anything that you need help finding or getting to.
I'd also let people know that on the website, we should have filed all the talks that we've been talking about doing that we've done each month, so that somebody who wants to join our task force could actually go back and listen to these talks. We didn't tape our business sections where we talked about what we're going to be doing and who's going to be on what subcommittee or anything like that, but the main basic educational talks should be posted on the website for you. So people can review things, and we can also, anybody who wants to join us, who wants to just have conversations with us to get up to speed, we'd be glad to help with that as well.
Alrighty. Well, I think we're at the end of our time here. We've really packed it in tonight. Thank you to John Powers and Reshma Ramachandran for all the information you've shared. And we hope that a number of folks listening on the call will decide to get involved with the task force. Thank you all very much. And please, just a quick reminder, our next call will probably be in about 2 months. They aren't exactly 2 months apart, but watch your email for the date and information. That'll be our next conference recall. And again, the recordings and notes for these calls are all archived at npalliance.org/conflict-free. And for more information, you can go to npalliance.org. And the Conflict Free Project is also one of the projects from the homepage if you forget the exact website address. Thank you all very much. Good night, and carry on.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.